Welcome to Things I Wish I Knew, the podcast from Thinking Faith, a work of the Jesuits in Britain. I'm Julia, I'm in my early 30s and I used to live in a Jesuit young adult community. We all live hectic lives and often don't get time to reflect on what's happening both to us and around us. This podcast is meant to help you to take a moment to stop and think about where you are, where you're going, and where your relationship with God fits into it all. Every week I meet a new guest who tells me about something they experienced which changed their life forever. By talking about the things they wish they'd known, we'll explore the idea that God is in all things. And we'll talk about the part that faith plays in navigating life's challenges. Today we're speaking with Antonia. This is the second part of the conversation. In the first part, Antonia shared her experience of healing from childhood abuse and how God showed up in ways she wasn't expecting. The themes in the last two episodes can be quite difficult, so please do check out the links in the description. In this episode, she's reflecting with us on what a truly healing church could look like. One that acknowledges pain, creates safety, and walks with survivors. So, Antonia, you mentioned this idea of being a missionary and not activist. What does this mean?
Yes, so I've lost count of how many priests who, when I actually speak to them in person, say, "You're an activist, but you're so nice." And I think on reflection, we've been mislabeled. And we understand that if someone is scared to talk to us, they're not going to talk to us. If they think we're going to bash them, there's no way they're going to talk to us. And we also know from practical experience that so many priests have experienced abuse themselves. Many of them have told me that even if they haven't experienced abuse in childhood or in seminary, that's quite common. You know, it's the idea that you're going to talk to someone who, you know, a few weeks ago might have spat at you down the street and called you a pedo. Are you really going to want to talk to somebody who does that? So we want to engage with people and we want to take a message of hope and of healing to the church because there are people suffering in the church. So it doesn't make sense for us to be seen as people who carry some sort of adversarial label with us. So we're missionaries. I think that fits much better with our work.
So I remember many years ago, like we're talking over a decade, if not 20 years ago, when the first element of the amount of abuse in the church started to come out, and talking to a Catholic priest who had been on a motorway journey and he had been wearing his dog collar, and he realized for the first time that people were looking at him like differently. Because before that, he used to say people used to see him and look at him with almost like in awe or reverence that he had chosen this. This is anybody like in a secular, more secular, not just in the Catholic Church. But suddenly at that moment on this particular journey, he realized people were looking at him in disgust and had brushed him with that same...
Tarred him with the same brush.
Mm-hmm. And there is a lot out there about where the church failed in its safeguarding. But is there anything positive that is happening in the church now? Because we're obviously in a very different place to where it was previously.
So the church is full of flawed human beings. And just like the rest of society, it's light and dark. We have much more robust policies. We have people who take it seriously. We have much more structured systems. I think that the church has travelled a long, long way with policy and procedure. A lot of people who perhaps before were hesitant and reluctant to get involved now understand the importance of reporting and calling it out. Where I would say that we still need to do a lot of work is the care for people that have suffered abuse. We need to break down stigma. We need to stop bashing each other. We need to stop buying into myths. Like a couple of common myths are that anyone who's in a position of authority, like a bishop or a cardinal, is out to cover it up. That's just not true. Another myth is that anyone who is talking about abuse in the church is anti-clerical and they're bashing the church. So at both wings of this, you've got people still propagating those myths. So challenging that culture, that's going to be something that my grandchildren will be doing and yours, I suspect. That's what makes us safe.
So how can people support those who've been abused?
I think the gift of listening. You can't fix somebody. They're not a broken vase, but you can listen. You can be there. There is a really profound difference between suffering on your own and suffering with the support of other people around you. When you're a child and you're keeping this terrible secret, the only way I can describe it is that you feel like you're constantly holding your breath. And when you're with someone who knows, and they know that something might be upsetting you, people have all sorts of triggers that bring them back to that place and time when it's happening to them. If you're with somebody who understands that, my golly, what a difference that makes to have someone hold your hand and say, I know that you're not in a good place, but actually you're not on your own. We're here with you, okay? That makes a big difference. It really does.
And for you personally, what does it feel like living with your story out in the open?
Liberating, I think. I don't have to walk around pretending. If something upsets me, it's fine. It's human to be upset. But if you can witness tragedy like this and it not upset you, then I think there might be something wrong there. So that's one thing. I would say really that the gift I've been given is that I have met so many people who have suffered abuse. I mean, horrifying abuse, and yet it didn't break them. And I think I walk in the company of saints when I witness people like this, because they've been tested in the hottest fire imaginable and it didn't get to take their faith away. It's astonishing. And as terrible as some of their stories are, I think what a gift to have met somebody like that.
I was just thinking back to that story you shared of you going into the church with the woman who was sobbing all into your shirt, and she turned around and she said to you, what are you doing? Mm. And in some ways it reminded me of like that quite often people ask that question, not just in this circumstance, but in lots of circumstances, what are you doing? Or particularly to God. But actually quite often God turns around and goes, well, you're there. I've put you there in this particular moment so that you can do something. And I had that really powerful like image in my head that that's in that moment what God was saying to you. And so do you feel like he used your experience in turning it into something that you could then do to support others in this circumstance?
I would say this. So there's nothing like being confronted by a room full of cardinals to give you some really quick perspective. It can be very intimidating, and I often feel very overwhelmed and underprepared, and I keep thinking God must have a sense of humor that he's put me here. But I think what I've learned is that God does not call the equipped. He calls who he calls, and he equips them how he says they have to be equipped. And that would be my message. Do not think that because you are not you don't have to be a psychologist. You don't have to be a doctor. You just have to be somebody who cares and will not pass by on the other side of the road. That's all he's asking.
And you mentioned having been in rooms with cardinals, and I know that you've met the Pope. How did that come about? What was that like?
Well, yeah, this is a bit unusual. So I was on Twitter posting pictures of Lao fences, and a priest contacted me and he said, I'm from the Diocese of Liverpool originally, and I'd like to hold a loud fence. And I said, well, we're already talking to the Archdiocese of Liverpool. I'll let you know when the date is. And he said, no, this wouldn't be in Liverpool. This would be in Rome. And I rather jokingly said, "Oh, who are you friends with?" "The Pope." And he said, "Well, I am his undersecretary. I am his secretary on the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors." And I thought, "You're just pulling my chain. I don't believe this." And I said, "Yeah, of course you are." And he sent me an email with a big papal insignia on it. And my daughter, Catherine, said, "Mom, what have you done? Who have you just disbelieved?" So luckily for me, Father Andrew has a sense of humour. He invited us to Rome. And I addressed the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors. And there is nothing that quite prepares you for walking into this marble hall, and there's just banks of tables with cardinals and bishops and photographers and interpreters, and you really find out what you're made of when you're confronted by something like that. And I felt scared to death. But I thought, actually, I don't want to live the rest of my life wondering what it would be like if I just had the bottle to say what I really felt about the whole thing. And so I did. And it must have had an impact, because after I'd addressed the commission, Cardinal O'Malley, Father Andrew and everyone at the commission held a loud fence at the little church opposite the commission's offices. And then I was asked a few hours after that to go and meet Pope Francis. And I took him a ribbon. I took him a letter from a religious sister who felt very deeply about the abuses that she'd witnessed in the church, especially the fate of the sisters who'd worked at the Centro Aleti. And I took a poem from a priest called Father Mark Skelton in Plymouth Diocese. And I said, "This is the church and this is for you." And he said to me, "You know, this," I gave him the loud fence ribbon, the same ribbon that's tied to Bishop Stephen's Cathedral in Newcastle. And he said, this is surreal that the Pope would say this to you. But he said, "You know, this is a symbol of hope for the global church, and you've got to take it everywhere." And I was just, I was there and I witnessed it all and it was unbelievable, but I still kind of pinch myself and think, I can't quite believe that happened. It was amazing.
So as we've been talking, I've noted that we've both had our eye drawn to the shells that you've brought into on the table. Obviously we're in audio, so our listeners can't see them. Can you give me a brief description of what they look like, but also why you've brought them in?
Right. Well, the first one is one of the shells from a pilgrimage that we did for the Jubilee year for survivors. So that was a way of giving to people who couldn't go into a church. It was a way of recognising the fact that they're still journeying with us. I used to be a statue restorer in my past life, and so it's gold leafed. And that's because everything that represents someone who's been harmed should be as beautiful as possible, because they've been made to feel like they're an ugly secret, like a scandal. And so everything we do is the opposite of how abuse should make them feel. And the other shell is basically the same sort of thing, a gold leaf shell, but it's got the logo for the Jesuits on it. And this is a reminder that together we journey together to a place of hope and healing. And that would be the message that I'm hoping to leave you all with.
So what do these shells represent?
So obviously the one with the Christogram on it, that represents the Jesuits. The other one represents the survivors of Father Marco Rupnik, who's undergoing canonical trial at the moment, particularly Sister Samuel. This is to give back to them, to tell them that they are loved and they are valued, to send a message of care and support from the rest of the church. Sister Samuel is making an exquisite mosaic in Paris at the moment, and she's encouraging messages from other survivors to be contributed to it. And this is a way of sending a message of support to her and also to the Jesuits, because we're all on this path together and nobody has an instruction book.
So what do you wish more people understood about survivors of abuse and their relationship with the church?
So people react differently when they're in pain. There are people who retain their faith and they're very angry and they lash out, and it's understandable. There are other people that just go quiet. So everyone's different. There is no archetypal type of survivor. But I feel that only a few are ever portrayed in the press. And they're always portrayed as people who are very broken and injured, and, you know, they're on drugs or they've got a drink problem or what have you. An overwhelming majority of people like that are not like that. They're actually really scared of coming forward. They don't want to be branded as damaged goods or broken or messed up or a troublemaker. They just want someone to support them. That's what I wish people would understand. And the people who've suffered abuse in the church, they are they're survivors, but there are also so many other survivors in the church. Don't make assumptions about who they are. The survivor could very easily be the priest stood in front of you, not the layperson stood next to you. I've spoken to bishops who are survivors, to religious sisters who are survivors. So don't make assumptions. Treat everyone as an individual, and don't sort of treat people who have suffered abuse as if they're all one kind of homogenous group. Anyone, beware of anyone who stands up on a soapbox and says, "I speak for survivors." They don't. There's 11.6 million people in this country affected by abuse. No one is able to speak for that many people.
So what is the difference between your relationship with God and the relationship with church?
So here's what you find out pretty quickly when you decide that you can't go back to the church, but you're wanting to stay a Catholic. The truth is that you can't be a Catholic without the Catholic Church. I know, I've tried. So when St. Cyprian said one cannot have God for one's father without having the church for one's mother, he's right. You need to be able to have a reciprocal relationship with God through the sacraments, and you can't gain access to the sacraments without the church. Those people that I saw, that the young couple that, you know, were trying to get married with a Catholic marriage rite in a hotel, the couple who were baptizing their own child on the beach. There was a lady called Frida who died. I used to say with the rosary with her every fortnight on Zoom, and she just wanted to take communion before she died, but she didn't feel comfortable with me telling the church where she lived who she was, and I wasn't allowed to take communion on the train down to where she lived. And all of that has taught me that you need the church. You can't run away from your problems. You've got to confront them. So the answer is not leaving the church, but making the church safer. So that means you've got to stay and work for that.
So what practical things can ordinary Catholics do to accompany survivors?
Ah, now there's a question. So you can hold a loud fence. Contact your parish priest, contact your bishop and say, well, this is something that's spread to dioceses all over the UK, and we'd like to hold a loud fence. get in contact with us. We've got a website, loudvents.com. We're holding workshops to make art that is able to make survivors visible and to send a message to them. So even if you can't hold a loud vents in your parish for practical reasons, you can be involved in a workshop that can make something to help someone in Plymouth or Strathclyde or wherever. So, you know, we're one church together. That would be my message.
And I also imagine loud vents is a great thing to do ecumenically as well. Yes. Coming in an area, bringing multiple churches together to create a loud vents together.
Mm. Yes, we try to encourage that. So Newcastle, Liverpool, Birmingham, these are all great examples of cities where the Catholic Church and the Anglican Church have got together and it's worked really, really well. They've supported each other. Because also, this is something that in the beginning was highly experimental. So if you were a bishop doing this, you had to be a brave soul, because it might work really well or it might fail spectacularly and then you'll be in the line of fire. So the idea that you're working together with other people from other denominations is incredibly helpful and reassuring.
So what do you wish you knew?
What do I wish I knew? I'll tell you what I wish I knew, but I'm kind of torn about this, because if I hadn't known it, I wouldn't have gone looking. And if I hadn't gone looking, then I wouldn't have been where I am now. And I feel that although there are times when this work is very, very difficult, it's also a great blessing. But what I do wish I'd known when I was there crying endlessly on the beach was that God goes to those broken places, and it's when we are at our weakest and we give everything to him, that's when he meets us where we are and we get to accompany him whilst he is healing us. It's far more complicated, and the message I would leave with everyone is simply this: there is no way that you can fix the Catholic Church more effectively from outside than you can from in it. So if you want to be part of the solution, and you are part of the solution, go back and be the solution. I always remember saying to people who are in the church and they're reeling from safeguarding scandals that have erupted, I've said, the fact that you are crying is the hallmark of the fact that you care. And if you care, you are an indispensable and critical part of the solution. So be glad for the tears, because it means that things are now going to get better.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Just to finish off, what are you grateful for?
I'm grateful for all the people I've met. I'm grateful for the gift of the people that I now know so well and that I count as friends. I think that for going through the terrible pain and the trauma of listening to the Pennsylvania grand jury report and all the countless tears that I've shed, I am now a far stronger Catholic than I ever was. And what I am grateful for is that now I am in the church to stay, and my faith has been forged in a fire that's reinforced it and made it so much stronger. So it's been a painful, invasive process, but it was worth it. That is what I'm grateful for.
Thank you for listening to Things I Wish I Knew. I know this episode is going to stay with me, because Antonia talks about how we all need to be within the church to help the church learn from its mistakes. How about you? We'd love to hear how Antonia's story resonates with you. And why not also tell us if you're facing an experience you wish you knew how to look at differently? It might just be something we can help with. You can find out more about this and other themes at thinkingfaith.org. Thank you again for listening. I hope you'll join me again next time on Things I Wish I Knew.